Hello and welcome back to another edition of Podcast from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. And I hope you all had a safe and happy Easter. My guest on this edition is special. Everyone knows who Phuthuma Nhleko is, but I meet very few people who actually know him or talk to him or about him. He's been a sort of quiet giant in South African business for two decades, to say nothing of black business. He avoids, or perhaps even evades, the media, gossip, and spectacle, but the record speaks for itself. A stint of close to 20 years, either as chairman or CEO of MTN, the biggest mobile operator in Africa. He's run two of his own successful investment funds. He's chair of the Johannesburg Securities Exchange, and he's been on the boards of a dozen major international and local companies, including BP PLC, Anglo-American PLC. He was educated in Eswatini and in the US, where he did a BSc in civil engineering, which is, I find civil engineers such intimidating people to speak to, and at Ohio State, and an MBA at Atlanta. And he's a fellow at the Blavatnik School of Government and Public Policy at Oxford University in the UK, all of which might explain why I'm both looking forward to and a bit nervous about talking to Phuthuma Nhleko today about a brand new, and I'm going to hold it up, and first book, The Invisible People, How a Quarter of Humanity Can Thrive in Africa by 2050, published by Penguin, which is in itself a difficult place to get into. Phuthuma, we've never met, but you hover in the best sense of the word in the minds of anyone covering business or the economy in South Africa. Does the book represent a departure for you, or are you still active in business and in your own ventures?
Well, first and foremost, thank you very much, Peter, for inviting me on your podcast. And I should say the civil engineers are the most humble and tame of the engineers. You should be petrified of the chemical engineers and metallurgical engineers. Those are the guys you should be petrified of. the book really is a culmination of a number of years in business, as you've described. I'm actually turning 66 tomorrow.
Oh, happy birthday.
Thank you. You get to a point where you start to pivot from, you know, wanting to accomplish certain things just purely from a professional career perspective, to trying to look at a broader horizon, longer horizon. And that's really what this book is about, is to say, you know, we're all going to expire at some particular date. And what do you see beyond that? And what contribution can you make beyond that? So, to answer the question, yes, still involved in business, but tapering off to things that I really want to do in business and then focusing more on writing books. And this is my first one.
Well, I really do hope there are more, because I really love this book. It's challenging and it's passionate and it's very, very well written. And you make a promise on the cover, though, that I'm not sure that you actually get to keep. When you ask the question, how a quarter of humanity can thrive in Africa by 2050, that in itself is an amazing question, because so few people realize just how quickly the population of this continent, our continent, is going to grow. My understanding is that by 2050, by which time I shall be a sprightly 97 and you'll just be a mere 89, one in 10 children in the world will be born in Nigeria. And as you say in your introduction, quoting Thomas Piketty, but you could have come across this figure in other sources as well, by the end of the century, Africa will be home to one in four people in the world. So it's the fastest growing population in the world. And of the top, as you say in the book, and I found this absolutely riveting, of the top 30 countries by fertility in the world, 29 are African. And then you rightly ask, what are the economic, social, and geopolitical consequences of these changes? What ructions will these changes trigger? But then, and I'll get to the end of my long question, while you beg the question, you anchor the answer in a revival of a notion or philosophy of a new Pan-Africanism, which is probably a lot like Pan-African has always been in its various iterations when it raises its head. And it's this idea that somehow Africa has to get its act together. And I wanted to ask you why you might think that's a reasonable and unromantic proposition. How do African countries, or do African countries have to wait until somehow they're all aligned? I mean, how does Pan-Africanism happen?
Yeah, well, I think let me say, you know, firstly that this huge population growth and acceleration is after really, you know, two huge interruptions. The first one, of course, you know, Africa, you know, for a long period, there was a lot of disease in many places. Then you had before that as well, the huge, you know, transatlantic slavery, as well as slavery, you know, to the Arab world and Islam. And those two events, or three events, had a huge interruption to the natural growth of the African population. In fact, in the book, I give statistics where in 1950, you know, Africa sort of assumes the sort of density or growth that Europe had in, let's say, 1850. So this is really a catch-up, for lack of better words, to describe it. Then you come to the second aspect of the question, which is really Pan-Africanism. Peter, I'm very much alive to the fact that a lot of people may see this as a very mythical, esoteric view of the world, because Pan-Africanism is not new, and I give many aspects of, refer to many aspects of it in the book. However, there is a very different perspective on Pan-Africanism in 2026 compared to 1850 or 1950, for that matter. And that is, there are some very commercial imperatives without which, which could not be achieved unless there's a Pan-African view. And what is that Pan-African view? It's consolidation, it's reducing trade barriers, it's getting scale, and so on. So these things, from my mind, are not ideological necessities, if I can put it that way. They are driven by saying, in the next 25 years, if Donald Trump comes around and says 30% tariff on South Africa, that is very different if it's 30% not on South Africa, but on a genuine trading bloc, all right? South Africa, for instance, can take all sorts of positions geopolitically, and this book is not about South Africa, if I should hastily add. You have far more leverage, once again, on your position in the world if you have got scale, you've got consolidation. So it's a rather long-winded way of answering a very simple question to say it's not ideologically driven. It is, I would say, commerce-driven. It is leverage-driven. And it so happens that if you go from that direction backwards, you still end up with a need for a very Pan-Africanist view of the world. So that's the way that I would look at that.
Can I just ask, though? I mean, so if, you know, elsewhere, and you write, and it's so interesting, you know, Egypt's place in the world, people think it's kind of, you know, the Europeans sort of took Europe, took Egypt and made it their own in a way, but you make the point that it was an African nation and an African civilization. But you know, over the long sort of sweep of history, these things sort of come and go. And what I wondered was, are there continental movements or schools of thought that you could identify today that worked because somebody set out to make them work? You know, so where somebody said, okay, well, you know, this continent here, South America or Asia or whatever it is, need to work together to make their place in the world. I'm just wondering how organic can this all be, or does somebody have to step up and speak for Africa and make it all happen? Because you say often in the book, Africa needs to do X or Y. But as I was reading it, I kept thinking, well, who in Africa? Who does this? Who actually does the work?
Yeah, well, let me say that social engineering is nothing new. The examples that I'll give you are on a country basis and maybe not on a continental basis, but the same principle applies, and I'll come back to the continental basis in a minute. But the examples that I often give is to say the Germany of 2026 is not the same Germany of the 1930s, right? The country had to reposition itself, look itself in the mirror and say, well, this is how we want to be seen to reflect in the world. The same applies to the United States. United States of 1776 and one of 2026 is different. In fact, I would argue that even the United States of 1965, before the franchise to vote was given to all, you know, Americans, including African Americans, is a very different one from 2026. It might not be an example that's palatable to some people, but after the Berlin Wall fell, and particularly after Putin came in, he repositioned Russia, you know, as big Rus, and, you know, and I guess it's part of the reasons that there's this conflict with Ukraine. So putting the merits aside, it was a social engineering. It's a social engineering of an identity of this is who we are, and so on. So there's a long list of examples, including China itself, you know, Mao, post-Mao, Deng, and so on. And I'm saying Africa is not so exotic and so unique in its complexity that it is impossible to do this. I think in the book, I even give the example of Russia with its, you know, 9 or 10 time zones. at one stage, was a very monolithic, you know, sense. So Africa can do that. Who does it? Of course, the apex of the union and the consolidation is the African Union. Now, I know that the African Union has got, you know, many, many challenges, including challenges of ensuring that the program trickles down to the countries and the countries do their bit. But it's not as though we would be beginning on a clean slate. The structures are there. The implementation is highly, it's got, you know, huge room for improvement. But that would be the apex. European Union has done the same thing. You know, just before 1945, as I always say, Europeans were killing each other and have been doing that for many years. But post-1945, the EU came into place. It was built block by block, and here it is today with all its warts. And I struggle to understand why that would be a far-fetched vision for Africa in the next 20 years.
So let me try and answer that, why it might be a far-fetched, or not impossible, but difficult. The point that you made about Egypt, for instance, so Egypt... And later in the book, you listen to somebody very interestingly telling you how West Africans are traders, but South Africans aren't traders, right? We do other things, and so I just wonder whether the fact of the continent can accurately describe or mold what it contains, because Egypt was also a Mediterranean country. You know, if you look at those cultures around the Mediterranean, including Greece, which had influenced greatly, and the Lebanon and southern Italy, and, you know, there are a lot of characteristics of civilization around the Mediterranean that you don't see, that you see in North Africa, but you don't see in Southern Africa, because we weren't there at the time, and we're quite recently here. I'm just trying to see if I can pick a hole in the continental thing, because I understand, you know, there's a plan at the AU it was Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma who did, was it 2063, right? I'm not quite sure what happens in 2063. We won't be around, sadly, but so there'll be nobody to hold to account for it. But what, you know, is it Is it realistic to expect a whole continent to move in the same way? I mean, if you can get like-minded countries in the same area, same region, to behave, you know, as one, that would be quite something. But this is a lot of people in a lot of countries.
Yes, Peter, those are very fair questions. I think let me say that Egypt is merely a data point. It's a very important one, but it's merely a data point. I also do think that contextually, you know, people always extrapolate the Egypt of today, you know, backwards. The Egypt of the past, the ancient Egypt, was very much a Afro-Asian culture. You know, as I say, you know, you can't have 6,000 kilometers of the Nile going all the way to Ethiopia and Egypt and Uganda, and then all of a sudden the culture stops at the Third Cataract or something like that. So we need to see it in that context, but it's also important to say it's one data point of many data points. Secondly, I would say that the uniformity of culture is not necessarily a imperative for there to be a union. So until recently, you had the Slavs in Europe, right? They were looked upon in a very low sense of the word by certain parts of Europe. So Europe itself has been a mosaic and a fabric for many, many years. You know, no different from Africa today. The old Soviet Union was a fabric. Even China today is a fabric. I mean, not everybody's Han Chinese and so on. So yes, I accept that there is not necessarily a uniformity of culture in Africa to say that, well, I can just mash it all together. But we've got plenty of examples where we are actually now different. Then I would say, we talk about 54 countries, of course, but even the EU didn't start off with 38 or 35 members. It started off with a few countries, and they built on that. In the mid-2000s, you had President Mbeki in South Africa, Wade in Senegal, Mele in Ethiopia, and Bouteflika in Algeria. And those four or five countries acted as a unit, you know, whether it was the debt rescheduling or debt cancelling and all sorts of geopolitical issues. So this has been done before, certainly not to the extent that I would wish, but it's an example that it can be done and needs to be repeated, where you take the four or five large economies in Africa, they become the piston, and then the rest will come in at a later stage. And maybe the last point on that question is, the Africa Free Trade Agreement, as I say, might be 50 years late, but it's there. It's still very much on paper. We still have to get, you know, intra-Africa trade from 16% to about 35% to be comparable to other regions in the world. But at least we've made a start. So I'm not, you know, belittling the challenges and the hurdles that have to be scaled. But I don't at the same time think that it's completely mythological.
I like that the four countries, it was South Africa, Algeria, Egypt, and was it Ethiopia? Yeah. So what happened to that arrangement? Why did you know, Thabo Mbeki did quite a lot. I mean, he started NEPAD, he started the sort of African Renaissance school of thought, and then he leaves power and it all fades away. It goes away. I mean,
no, that is unfortunate, Peter. But I mean, you know, this is, I guess, life. You know, I guess there's all sorts of complexities and reasons in the various four countries. You know, Mele's, you know, passed away in Ethiopia. Bouteflika became very ill in Algeria. I think Wade was also pretty advanced in age. And Obasanjo left, and we've also had our own challenges. So sadly and unfortunately, those four or five jockeys sort of left the scene, and the continuity wasn't there. But I'm hopeful that this can be reestablished because it is pivotal.
So you also quite rightly condemn the kind of thinking that would have rationalized, you know, the transatlantic slave trade. And you write very movingly about efforts to recreate a sense of and a knowledge of African history and culture. I loved that part of the book. And you enjoyed Howard French's Born in Blackness and Zainab Badawi's An African History of Africa. You lament the fact that European schools teach more about ancient Egypt than do African schools. And on more than one occasion, you have a go at Helen Ziller for her remarks a decade ago or so about the effect that colonialism brought with it some lasting benefits. Is there an actual remedy now? I mean, beyond your dream, are there little steps that can be undertaken, and that would move us forward rather than constantly have to reach back and compare, you know, whether we're doing better than in 100 years ago. So, I mean, how do you move it forward? How do you actually, you know, it seems to me, Putuma, that asking the AU, like any large group of, you know, bureaucratic organization, to make something happen is a bit ambitious, a bit optimistic. How does this move forward?
Yeah, well, I think as I've mentioned, Bruce, well, I really wouldn't want the book to be seen as a basket full of a litany of historical grievances. That's not what it is. That said, it's very important that everything be contextualized. But you then say, where does the rubber hit the road? What do you do practically? I will maybe mention two or three examples that are not exhaustive, but I think are indicative. I think firstly, we've spoken about the Africa Free Trade Agreement. I think that's fundamentally important. And, you know, it needs to be built on, as I mentioned, to get into Africa trade from 16% to about 30%. Secondly, I have a very strong view about the mobility of people and labor and so on. So the borders have to be flattened. Now, that doesn't mean that they need to be flattened in a disorderly manner and therefore precipitate, understandably, you know, xenophobic views and so on. But it's all about scale. This whole thing is about scale. And we found a way to start doing that on the telecom side, which I'll give as an example in a moment. But I'm really saying, the second practical way is to say you need the free movement of people, because as much as there is, you know, brain power in country A and B and C and D, you know, part of the value of being to take the brightest Ethiopian and bring them to South Africa, take the brightest South African and bring them into Ethiopia, and vice versa, or Nigeria, Uganda, that's really what enables us to optimize on our intellectual capacity and depth. And we did this at MTN over many years. You know, we were in 22 countries. We would take a native of Uganda and he'd go and serve as MD in Ghana, take the Ghanaian and he'd go and serve as a CEO in Nigeria, etc. And I just thought that the power of the diversity that created is enormous. So that needs to be done. Third example is what I referred to as leapfrogging in the book. And the obvious example that everybody knows, you know, in 2000, 2001, there was maybe 600,000 fixed lines for a population of over 120 million people in Nigeria, right? In 2026, I don't know what the total number of mobile users are in Nigeria, but I would say, you know, maybe over 200 million or 220 million, whatever the right number. The point being, Nigeria jumped the copper age completely, right? You can give a similar example on M-Pesa in Kenya on banking, an example that's been flogged to death, but it's still a very important one. The people who've never been into a brick and mortar bank ever in their life, but today to do all their banking. And I still know a lot of states in the US where people are still writing checks, right? In Texas and Montana and so on. So I'm just saying the increasing of the intertrade, the flattening of the borders so that you can get an orderly movement of people and intellectual brain power, and then the technical leapfrogging, all right, in a number of sectors. I've just given banking and telecoms, but yeah, that really needs to start to crystallize a formula of saying, how does Africa begin to skip part of the third industrial revolution and go to the fifth and to the fourth? And I don't think that's a complete dream. I think it's a realistic proposition, but it's going to require huge focus, huge organization, and long-term planning.
It really resonated with me too, actually, because I have some strong thoughts about industrial policy in our country as being largely a waste of time. But I'm going to get there, Putuma. I want to just ask you quickly. So you make the point in the book that, and you say this, and I'll quote you, the essence of Pan-Africanism is solidarity among and between Africans and Black diasporans, right? The Black diaspora, former slaves or whatever. But that this engagement has waned since the 70s. It gets revived by Thabo Mbeki in his famous speech modeled on Pixley Kasema's speech in New York in 1912, I think it was. And that waned too. And you ask, how can this spark be reignited? And you say, to see itself anew, Africa must look outwards to the world to overcome, and I love this phrase, the vanity of small differences and the divisions they create. And that's not going to be done by a committee, you know. That needs to be done by a leader. Someone has to be that person, or at least that group of people, maybe those four leaders or another version of them. I kept thinking, and you've answered the question, I'm sorry to repeat that, is how, you know what I mean? How, what can these things happen without a champion?
Yes, of course, leadership is very important, Peter, but these things have happened before. So just to give you a few examples, pre the 1965 Voting Rights Act in the US, all right, there was an enormous collaboration, just to give an example, between then African Americans, at the time they weren't called African Americans, they were called Black Americans or other, you know, names that were derogatory. And there was huge collaboration between them and, you know, the African leaders at the time, because a lot of African countries were also, you know, pushing for independence and so on. In the cultural sense, there was also a lot of collaboration. You know, you talk about Miriam Makeba, you know, the impact that people like Miriam Makeba had on, a lot of the African-American cultural scene is very, very, Nina Simone, right? It's very, very, very strong. Then you look, as a second example, the lead up in the apartheid era right up to 1994, certainly, I was a student in the United States at the time. People like Randall Robinson, Andrew Young, the late Jesse Jackson, it's a long list of people. There was enormous collaboration, right? Now, it disappeared at some point, which is what I'm decrying here. But I'm just saying these things were there. They were in place. Yes, it took leaders, not a leader. It took a number of leaders. Here and across the Atlantic to make those things work. So what I'm saying in 2026 is those links need to be revived. The African Americans themselves are in the halls of power of, you know, arguably the most powerful country in the world today, right? Coming from a history that would, where the odds would have been enormously against them to be where they are today. And I'm saying that we should not be apologetic as Africans or South Africans, in the broad sense of the word, of re-engaging those relationships and so on. You say, what does it take? Well, it takes a plethora of leaders with different skills and different backgrounds to achieve that. I don't think it's one guy with a magic wand saying, well, I'm going to do this, right? But it's a mindset, and the book is partly dedicated to Africans that are in the 20s to the 40s, because that's really the message that I'm trying to push. Yeah.
I mean, you argue that, for instance, and these are some of the littlest, smaller steps, but steps nonetheless, bringing back artifacts plundered by colonial powers, right? And you say that this would offer a chance for ordinary Africans to reconnect with the continent's past and strengthen a common identity. And you say here, and this is once again quite hopeful of you, I thought, once restitutes and gathers speed, a virtuous circle will be created. More and more pressure will be exerted on Western countries to give back what they once plundered. That's fine. Museums would be founded and filled across the continent with welcome knock-on effects such as a boost for intra-African and foreign tourism. And, you know, I mean, I don't know. I don't know who goes to museums anymore. I suppose I would in Paris or London if I wanted to see a particular painting or not. I just wonder whether you know, after the last rise and fall of this Pan-African sort of urge, I just wonder whether kids today, the 20 to 40 that you're talking to, whether they care about that anymore. They're so busy. You know, it's life is very different now. You and I would have grown up in a period where you got a good education, you went to university and you worked hard until somebody decided you were too old and you had to stop working. People don't work that way anymore. I mean, everything seems to be fragmented into little bits of things that are hard to put your arms around and say, this is A and this is B.
I think there are a number of points there. The first one is that the evolution of cultural identity does not happen in a pigeonhole. It's a whole range of things that happen that helps to relook at that identity. The cultural aspects, the museums, it's just one element. I think the Greeks are still trying to get the Parthenon marbles back from the United Kingdom, right? The Orthodox Church, yes, the Orthodox Church has come back in Russia, right? You know, where was the Orthodox Church when the Berlin Wall fell? Confucianism has come back in China, right? The Confucianism had been kicked out the door in 1949. And so these are real live examples, Peter, of the last 40, 50 years. And they happen in parallel, not in series. It's not a question of saying, well, now we're going to deal with a museum, now we're going to deal with this and so on. It's a holistic evolution of identity. The young people that you mentioned actually are part of the people that have really, really inspired me to write the book. Because if I look at how the popular culture today, which is founded in many respects on African culture, on Black culture, is going very, very strong. I don't think you can go into a bar in New York today and not hear Amapiano playing, right? Or in a bar in China or Paris and so on. So some of this is almost self-generating without really necessarily needing somebody to say, you know, I'm the leader and I'm going to change this. There is, all ideas have their time, and when that time arrives, there's a particular momentum that begins to emerge. Yes, for sure, there needs to be strong leadership in various facets, like you may have heard during the anti-apartheid movement on two different continents, but I'm quite certain that this is going to evolve. I think the book was merely saying, look, I'm ringing the alarm. that the pace at which it needs to evolve needs to be much more rapid than it's happening today, because the consequences of the exponential rise in population growth, the needs that it's going to have to serve, and the pace at which we're moving, there is almost a divergence. If we don't move fast enough, we are, you know, looking at a ticking socioeconomic bomb here. So I think all the things that you've asked have happened before or are happening, and it's a question of how do they get knit into something that works. Look at India, and again, I'm touching on sensitive ground here, you know, booby minds, because people have got different views. But I think you'd be hard-pressed not to accept that what Modi has done on India's identity in the last sort of 10 years was almost unimaginable, even when I was at MTN talking, you know, with Bharti. Okay? So these are all the points, yeah.
You move from the sort of cultural side onto economics and natural resources and the way African resources have been extracted and continue to be to develop non-African economies. And you say at some stage in the book, even today, African countries still do not fully control the commodities they extract and trade, which is a significant inhibiting factor. The drivers of African extraction are the commodities needed in Asian and European economies. But once again, you go beyond that and you say, well, hang on a second, that may be true, but the fact that Africa only contributes 3% to total GDP obfuscates, hides the tremendous resources that can be harnessed this time for Africa's benefit. And once again, particularly because we're talking mainly about mining and minerals, how does that happen? Even in South Africa, you know, we've made it almost impossible for miners to mine and process their minerals in our country because our electricity is so expensive. How do we hold on to our In fact, let me ask you two questions. I do apologize, because you go on to say, look, manufacturing may not be the the be all and end all of where we're going, right? Because you land on a digital future, and that this is now what we've got to take care of, because you don't want Africa losing control of its data. That's the last great resource because of all these people. But how do you get Putuma from looking after your minerals and then kind of owning your minerals and then really not doing much with them other than digging them up, perhaps processing them to be manufactured into things elsewhere? Because the manufacturing race has already been won. It's all in Asia. It's in China and Thailand and Vietnam or wherever. And you make the point there's no point trying to compete with that.
Yes, Peter, we actually may be in agreement here. Let me try and unpack it. Okay. So the economics of extraction, I think the first point that I argue is that in many respects has not changed considerably over the last 600 years. In fact, it actually got worse because, you know, if you look at the artisanal miners or whatever you want to call them, in Ghana, the Ashanti region before the Europeans came, they were actually controlling, that mining of the gold and selling the gold. This is how the story of Mansa Musa and people like that, come up. All I'm saying is that since the colonial times, the control of the value chain of extraction has not changed fundamentally and has always favored really people outside Africa, whether it be the West or China and so on. And in the first instance, I'm saying, this is a God-given endowment that we have to really revisit from a value chain sharing more than anything else. In fact, there are some studies that have shown that the countries that have been more minerally endowed have turned out to be poorer than those that are not, whether it's a Dutch disease or what have you, and the abuse, etc. So it's there. There's a lot to be done. As I said, the book is not really about South Africa, but I did give an example of, you know, when I was at Anglo, and you know, we had to meet the regulators in mining in Australia, and there was something to be said about how they interact with me.
Well, let me read you what you did say about them, because I'm looking at the page as you speak. So you say you remember meeting the officials from the Australian Ministry of Mines, right? And you say, "I was struck by the depth of their expertise, experience, vision, and their integrated business approach towards mineral management, from production to logistics to transformation. They had a symbiotic relationship with the private sector and did not consider business interests and objectives as being against the national interest." And you say you've got significant issues dealing with Australian foreign policy, but you know, its ability to take full advantage of these commodity cycles and super cycles has helped the country maintain a good GDP over long periods. And unfortunately, South Africa is among the African countries that have let that opportunity go begging. And if that's so obvious to you, and given the position you occupy in this society and our body politic, Why do we're still not anywhere close to getting the opportunity back?
Yeah, Peter, I accept that, and this is why I say these things, because I see them and I believe them. That said, it's not as though, you know, I don't appreciate the complexity that we've had to deal with in the last, you know, 35 years. All I'm just saying is that our ambition should be to have a far more integrated strategy, particularly to take care or advantage of these super cycles in minerals. So I wouldn't want this to come across as though I'm just being critical. I'm trying to set a vision here where I think the mineral endowment in Africa as a whole, not only South Africa, we can talk about, you know, oil in Nigeria, and I give an example of the oil proceeds in Nigeria versus, let's say, Norway and Angola, where Norway has got, you know, maybe a fraction of what they have, but they've got a sovereign wealth trend with trillions of dollars. So I think that is the theme here. I'm saying there's a lot to be done. The endowment is there and so on, but we need to relook at the value chain sharing. Beneficiation is spoken about perennially for, you know, years and years and years, but it just never happens. So there's nothing profound, nothing new. I'm just identifying that this would be done, and I think anybody that's honest would accept that. Then we come to the issue of services. So then you come to the issue of services. You know, as much as even the U.S. and the new administration in the U.S., you know, talks a lot about going back to manufacturing and so on. I mean, I still got a vivid memory when I first landed in Ohio State in 1980. You know, the steelworks in part of the state and so on, which of course, you know, in Columbus, you know, and that's all disappeared. So for all the political noise, even the United States in 2026, I believe manufacturing is something like 8% or even less. The world is going back into services, and it's going to digital. So I tie that back by saying that our planning for the next 25 years is, yeah, of course, if you can assemble BMW and Volkswagen and so on, you know, for export market, I'm saying we should take advantage of that. But I'm saying this should not be our absolutely core focus. That's not going to pay the dividends going forward. What's going to pay the dividends going forward is getting ready for a digital future. Well, it's three blocks. One's extraction, which we've spoken about, and I've given my comments. The second one is services, where getting ready for that new digital future is fundamentally important. And then the third leg is agriculture and agrarian, where, you know, if you look at Southeast Asia, it was all the small farmers supported by government that made it work. I'm not saying it's the only thing, but it was one of their key attributes that made it work. That is worth emulating. But I don't think that we can manufacture an exhaust pipe today cheaper than, you know, very, very cheaply than Vietnam.
But it won't be. It won't be for want of trying, I can assure you. But what you're describing is what I've believed for as long as I've been trying to think about these things, is that we should do what we're good at. You know, and we're good at, what are we good at here? We're good at mining. We know how to sink a shaft and get things out of the ground. And we used to be able to process them, but then electricity became so expensive, somebody else took that away. And we're good at farming. And how much, you know, and you look at all the land that isn't being farmed, let alone the issues about transformation and you know, ownership and all that. But the land that the government sits on and the amount of people who we are led to believe want to farm it, and nothing happens. It's just crazy. We could feed the entire world from this country, let alone the continent, which I'm sure the same would apply, you know. There, those mining skills are in Zambia. They'll be in the Congo. And if we could somehow just do what we do well, like the West Africans who know how to trade, you know, that's fine. Let them do that. That's probably where everything should be traded. But the digging up of stuff and the processing of it, we know how to do that, you know. But we don't know how to make carburetors and fridge, you know, whatever it might be. I mean, the manufacturing seems to me to be not beyond us, but out of our reach because it's somebody else has taken it. And as you say, data is there for the taking. And you guys at MTN have taken a lot. But, you know, how do you explain Canal Plus coming into South Africa and taking over MultiChoice or DSTV, whatever it was called? I mean, that's not the way things should be happening, surely. Canal Plus now owns a large part of our knowledge about ourselves in Africa.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, Peter, what I'd say, you know, and it's very important for me to say this, I'm not trying to be jack of all trades and master of none, because I fully appreciate that in each of these areas, there is a lot of complexity, there is a lot of challenges, and of course, you know, again, I keep on saying this book is not about South Africa because each country has got its own eccentricities. But if you take South Africa, for example, it's got, you know, a legacy that we all know that makes things even more complicated. What I am saying, however, is that I feel strongly that this vision, Pan-African vision, which oddly enough is applicable to most countries in Africa, is really, in my view, should be our economic blueprint from what up until now has been a relatively elusive model, economic model, with all sorts of things that I speak about in the books. But definitely the extraction, the agriculture, and the services, I think that's really where the most significant amount of our taxes should be invested in, our energy, our brain power, and so on. And in an extraction, of course, in Africa, in the broad sense of the word, I'm including, you know, oil and gas and so on. So that's really what I believe. Now, I do know that there are some people who have a vociferous reaction and saying, no, we should be manufacturing. You know, as I say, I'm not persuaded in, you know, on that. Because I think we need to look at where we are in the global cycle of transformation. You know, we're not in 1986 or in 2026. And that's, we need to play to our strength in that view. So that's my humble opinion on that. Yeah.
And so you end the book with the following advice. You say Africa must pursue three strategies, right? Raise its collective commercial voice to promote its own interests, fine. Develop alliances across the global south and within the African diaspora to pursue aligned interests. I'm not quite sure how that looks. And then maintain, and I so agree with this, maintain a progressive neutrality towards the superpowers. Avoid demonstratively taking sides while advancing values, progressive values that resonate across the continent. And I guess, I really admire you for writing the book, because I think you ask an impossible question in a way. And even though you're able to, you know, you're able to hold your ground and say, well, it's not impossible, because if certain things fall in certain ways. So I think it's a really brave book, and I hope it does. I hope it does well. And thank you for speaking. But I've got a few other questions, just three more, Phuthuma, that I'd like to raise. If I can ask you just a few typically South Africa-related questions, because you've been around and you know everybody. How do you view the GNU in South Africa at the moment, and what do you think its prospects are up to and after 2029? Has it been a positive thing?
Yes, I certainly think it's been a positive thing, because, you know, there's a guy who wrote a book, and oddly enough, that book, I think, was covered in the Sunday Times yesterday. I think his name is John Studwell, and he's written this book. He did a book on Asia some years back, and then he spent the last 10 years doing one on Africa. And one of the themes that he came up with, which I do agree with, is that the countries that have been successful in Africa, and he gives sort of three or four examples, are those that made a concerted effort to have an inclusive government. Now, inclusive is a broad word that you can use in different ways, but the GNU, in some respects, is that, right? It is tried to bring into the net disparate parts of South Africa in a country, you know, which has a complicated and difficult history. But as much as nobody sat there and said, I'm going to do the GNU, the voters decided. And the politicians had to follow. I think it was fortuitous, and in my humble opinion, is all for the better, because it allows us sort of built-in checks and balances, right, on the one hand. And then on the other hand, it allows us to try and tap more of the intellectual capacity broadly in South Africa. I always said that if I was an actuary and I had to try and do a calculation of the amount of brain power South Africa has lost since the 1940s, and I'm not talking just white people, I'm just talking everybody, right? Yeah. Whether even an artist like Gerard Sokoto, who went to Paris, it would be eyebrow-raising number. And when you do have these inclusive collections, GNU is a very South African, obviously, aspect of it. I think you end up with a much better outcome, a stronger outcome. Diversity is always power, and I mentioned this a little bit earlier, and that was what I experienced in my own business life, right? We had all people from different cultures, different countries, and that's really what made the company very, very powerful. It's dangerous to immediately just transpolate or through conjecture say, well, because it happens in a company, you can now easily, translate that to a country. I do understand, the danger of simplistic nuances, but at core, I fundamentally believe that that's important. And it's a long-winded way of answering your simple question, but the answer is yes. I think it was good. And yeah, I am an optimist.
I'm going to put you down as an optimist, and And Cyril Ramaphosa's reforms are going to have the desired effects, or do they get swamped by events? You know, by a Trump. I mean, a madman who just lives inside his own brain or head.
Well, I think we're doing our best. Government's doing its best. Our president is doing the best. Real politique will always get in the way, not only in South Africa, anywhere in the world, right? There's always real politique. But basically, are we on the right path? Are we on the right trajectory? My answer is absolutely yes.
And what would you do? What would you do, if anything, about BEE, Black Economic Empowerment, as it is now? I mean, should it be replaced or reformed or readjusted? Your colleague over at Investec, Rathfani Titi, suggested late last year, and I think he said something like, well, I've got it in front of me, the most delicate question is one we can no longer postpone, he says. At what point should South Africa move beyond race as a primary proxy for disadvantage? Race shaped our history and still shapes access to opportunity. To deny that would be disingenuous, but inequality and underdevelopment are global, complex global problems in which race is but one of many problems. I mean, is there any part of that that you agree with?
No, I may agree with some aspects on it, but wholly I don't necessarily agree. And by the way, I do touch on this in my book, to say that, you know, I guess I'm a centrist by nature, and that makes me very practical. To say, on the one hand, you can't say people who had a huge advantage in life merely by their pigmentation, for two centuries, three centuries, four centuries, get to bank that, right? And say, you know, after a tenth of that, okay, it's all done, for all forgotten and so on. I mean, that is unrealistic, because that way you are never going to close one of the biggest challenges facing South Africa and many countries like South Africa, which is the increasing degree of inequality, right? So that's a fact of life. On the other hand, there is no doubt that certain things have to be relooked anew in terms of structure, in terms of implementation, because my view is that the biggest beneficiary of transformation in BEE have actually been the South African white corporates. You know, pre-1994, you know, capital was imprisoned in South Africa. An Anglo-American invested in anything from mining to, you know, a shoe factory. Okay, I'm exaggerating. After 1994, they're able to export the capital. Look at how the banks have done and so on. So it's not a simple question. What I will concede is that it has not worked in a manner that one would have hoped it would have worked. Look at the capitalization on the JSE as an example. It doesn't reflect 30 years. Okay. So, Peter, something has to be done, but I wouldn't agree with a view that says all of a sudden, you know, those that have banked the 300 years of advantage get to keep it, without us finding a formula and a framework that doesn't inhibit, investment attractiveness, doesn't inhibit growth, but at the same time tries to close this unacceptable gap of inequality. That would be my position.
Yeah, just on that, on the point that I think gets most people who most critics of BEE, isn't the workplace stuff? It's the rule that requires, if you want to do a greenfield investment, and everyone talks about Elon Musk in this thing, but let's leave him out of it. If I wanted to start a greenfield shoe factory in East London, I couldn't without finding somebody, some black partners to give 30% of the business to. That surely is a barrier to investment.
Yes, and I don't profess to be an expert on government's position on all the nuances and key aspects of this, but I believe, you know, one would be hard pressed to find anybody in government who says, no, don't look at this at all, there are no problems and so on. I don't think so. My sense is that government has been saying, look, we accept that there are challenges. Let's try and see how we do things in a manner that doesn't impede investment, doesn't impede progress, but we also can't pretend that somebody else didn't have a 300-year head start. So that's really where we are. And I'm the incurable optimist. I think a solution will come.
Yeah. Last question, Phuthuma. Thank you so much for your time here. About MTN itself, your home for so many years. How dangerous are the lawsuits in the US, and now there's a grand jury investigation into whether or not, as a partner in Iran and I think in Afghanistan, that MTN services would have aided US enemies and possibly played a part in the deaths of American soldiers? I mean, is this something far away and really not worth worrying about, or is it a real threat to the company and to some of the people, including yourself, and possibly even Cyril Ramaphosa?
I don't think so, Peter. I mean, you know, probably the best phrase I would use that is often used in the US is called, you know, ambulance chasing, and I'm sure you've heard of that phrase. You know, these things are very spurious and so on. Are there opportunistic people who try to make A connect B, B connect C, D? By the time you get to Z, you don't know what they're talking about, right? It's those kind of cases. That said, you know, the US is a very litigious society, and of course, you know, geopolitics is always there, and therefore the company does what it needs to do. But I'm not in a position to, I'm no longer a director, I'm no longer an executive, only Ruff can talk about that. But yeah, that's how I see it. I mean, that's really how I see it. Yeah.
Listen, Phuthuma Nhleko, it's really been a real privilege to speak to you today. We've never met, and I'm so glad I've had this opportunity. We live very far apart now in South Africa, so unlikely to sort of bump into each other at the local Woolies. But thank you so much for giving me your time, and good luck with your new book, The Invisible People, How a Quarter of Humanity Can Thrive in Africa by 2050. And thank you all for listening. I'll be back next week with another edition, a podcast from The Edge. Until then, keep safe and bye-bye.